Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Hamburg, and good morning, remote participant. Yes, I'm Thomas, co-founder and CTO from FlexOptics. I'm these days mainly involved in the technology part of in FlexOptics, doing currently testing and establishing links on 400 gigabit with customers. And I brought you a topic today, especially the title is the complexity of hyperspeed transceivers. And I want to look into the transceiver itself to give you a little bit of better idea and understanding what really happens inside there. And you can compare it a little bit with when I started networking, 100 megabit was somehow commodity, and 1 gigabit was somehow the bleeding edge. And then these days also Google started to offer their services. They used at these days a broker for 1,000 switch to connect their compute nodes with each other. Now, roughly 20 years later, actually 10 gigabit is commodity and 100 gigabit becomes commodity and 400 gigabit is somehow the bleeding edge. When you also compare the network you have built 20 years ago with the network today, even inside the network itself on the logical level as well, or layer, the complexity got up pretty much. The same happened to transceivers, and that's what I want to talk now. So first of all, here's a comparison. What you see there of a 10 gigabit SFP plus on the up there, and then below I opened up a 400 gigabit QSFP DD for you. And the components I want to show today is especially the transmitter and receiver part, the golden boxes actually, and that's also where the artificial word transceiver comes from. When you combine transmit and receive, you get transceiver. And then there is a new component in there, we got this fancy, here we go, which is quite new, introduced to pluggable modules, to pluggable transceivers. It's a digital signal processor, the DSP, who is mainly in charge of two functions. The first one is to take care about the modulation, you have might heard about in our set and PAM4, but that's not the content of the talk today. And the second function is the forward error correction, and that's actually what I want to cover as well at the end of the presentation. So let's start with the transmitter section. And so we basically have a golden box there, and that's a really cut or CAD drawing out of production. So when we open up this golden box, which has a dimension of 5 by 10 millimeter, and that's really important to remember, we get a golden connector on the left side, which connects this transmitter, which is also called TOSA. It's a transmitter optical subassembly in optical engineering. It connects the electrical connector to the PCB itself of the transceiver where the DSP and the microcontroller is placed, and then this PCB again is going to connect to your host, to your switch and router. So first of all, we need to place some components in there, and the first one is the laser diodes. As we are talking about 400 gigabit, but also applies to a 100 gigabit transceiver, we do have 4 laser diodes because we are running 4 lanes there actually, and at a speed of 112 gigabaud for a 400 gigabit transceiver. And so we have 4 of them, and when you do the math, you get 400 gigabit. And these laser diodes do have 2 characteristics, basically. First of all, they consume current, and every component which consumes current heats up. And secondly, those laser diodes are pretty much like unfocused light is coming out there. So there is light, it's emitted light, but it's not focused at all. Pretty much like when people are wearing glasses and when they take it off, especially after a day like last night, you don't see anything or you don't see much. So we have to take care about that for the laser diodes, and the first thing is we place there a cooler, and this cooler also takes current again, and this current cools down actually with the characteristic of that cooler, the laser diode. Why is that important? We want to stabilize the laser diode actually to keep its wavelength, because when we let it heat it up to a certain temperature, it will drift away from the wavelength, and that's what we want to avoid. Because you can imagine when the wavelength is going to drift away, the link will have a bit errors at the end of the day. So the first goal is to keep the wavelength stabilized. The second one is to get the unfocused light focused, you need lenses. And those lenses, you have to imagine the XYZ dimensions, we are talking about 0.5 millimeters of such a lens. And during production stage, these lenses are going to be placed in 50 nanometer steps in XYZ. And then when they have the perfect spot, when they're in focus, then they are fixed there. And that's a tricky process, actually, because typically it's done with UV hardening glue, which fixes the lenses at this position. But this glue also needs to last for the next years and decades and keeps his consistency, because when it would change it, the lens would also change its position, and then we would be out of focus again. So that's a really tricky part, and to build it, actually, and to assemble it. So what we get now is we got a four wavelength focused light, but as you can imagine, these these four wavelengths here, they only hit the wall of the golden box, but we want to have them in our LC receptacle down there. So how do we achieve that? We add an optical multiplexer, and that's a filter block, which makes actually use of pretty simple physics principles with an angle. So what happens there is the light is hitting the walls or the angled wall of our filter block, and then it's going to be bouncing back and forward down to that corner here where we can combine all the four wavelengths and then insert it into our receptacle. That's actually how it's done in a multiplexer, and it's a really tiny one. Now we are on the line, and when we move on, the four wavelengths are on the line hitting our receiver now. And at this stage, it's again an opened gray box, not a golden anymore, but the color doesn't matter here. So actually, it works basically the other way around. So we need a demultiplexer, and this demultiplexer also separates all the four wavelengths again for us. Same principle here, bouncing back and forward, and at the certain filter which we have here, for example, the green one, it only allows to pass the green light, and the other color is going to be bouncing back and forward again down to the yellow filter, and only the yellow light is allowed to pass that filter. So now we have separated all the four wavelengths again, and then we need to hit again optical lenses to get focused light to a pin diode, which is the counterpart component of our laser diode, which does the conversion from the optical light level to an electrical signal at the end of the day. This electrical signal has a really low amplitude, so we can't use it actually on post-processing systems like on your ASIC or the DSP. They can't handle that signal. So what we do there is we need an amplifier in that golden box in there. There is one side story. If you have made that experience already, when you used a ZR transceiver, 10 gigabit ZR doing like 80 kilometers, and when you have connected this transceiver back to back without any attenuation, you might have experienced something like, oh, the link is up, and then after 5 seconds, the link is down again. And actually, this transceiver is broken then afterwards. What happened there is the diode itself, it is not broken, but what you burned or what you break was the amplifier. The amplifier got too much current in there in the input, and it boosted it up way too much, and then actually it pulled a lot of current, and this current killed actually the amplifier. So you can repair it, just replace the amplifier, open the box and change the amplifier if you want to, so the diode is still alive. You need a good microscope and weak hand. When we move on now, so we have the transmitter section and the receiver section, and I pointed out for that presentation a little bit about the production, which I think is quite interesting to see when it comes to higher speeds, what actually happens during production and what is important to know. And I pointed out the timing. So what you see on that graph here, I have three curves actually, and I put it into three sections as well. So on the x-axis you see three types of transceivers, 10 gigabit, 100 gigabit, and 400 gigabit. On the y-axis, that's the timing in minutes. The blue line actually describes the assembly time, and that's quite obvious when we look down there. The 10 gigabit transceiver takes roughly 8 minutes to assemble and to test. The green curve is testing. But when we move on at 100 gigabit, this gap actually got pretty much wider, because the testing, it has a way steeper rise there. Assembly has a steady growth actually, so it's a more complex component we were gonna assemble, but the testing is way more complicated and way more time consuming. And especially when we come to 400 gigabit now, still steady growth here, so we're talking about roughly when we build them in batches of 25 minutes to assemble a wall transceiver, but the testing got up to roughly 90 minutes. And now you can imagine, if you want to cut down costs or want to save money there in production, actually you don't do that on the assembly, because there is not much margin in for you. But if you want to do that on the testing, this is a good and a bad thing. If you do it in a good manner, you automate your processes. That's a good way. Then you get down timing or the time. But you can also just get rid of tests, and then you can also cut down the time there, but maybe that's not a good choice. One example for a test could be, let's take the temperature, and there are actually, let's say, two different ways to test. One would be, we just cool it down, the transceiver, to 0 degrees centigrade, measure the optical performance. If we are bit error-free, great, check. We're gonna heat it up to 70 degrees. It's fine. You might see during this testing stage that one wavelength is going to drift away a little bit. Like this one here, the spectrum of the green wavelength is going to drift away a little bit, but at some stage it's going to be normalized again. This would be one test case. But you can also make it more complicated or say, well, we had a second variable there, we had the time. So when we say we cool it down within 30 seconds from room temperature 20 degrees to 0 degrees, keep it there, and after 30 seconds again, it needs to be stabilized. And if it doesn't do it, it's a failure part. It might stabilize after 5 minutes, but we want to have it stabilized after 30 seconds. The same, what we're gonna do is we heat it up within 60 seconds to 70 degrees centigrade coming from 0 degrees, really to the hot area, and also do the same measurement there to see how long it takes, or give a threshold there, until the lasers are going to be stabilized again. And that's a totally different test you do there. At the end of the day, it's a temperature test, but either taking the time in consideration or not. That this is a, I think, an important way to know, if you do testing, do it the right way to get a proper result, because otherwise you will end up in failure parts at the end of the day. Another example here is, I made a drawing of an artificial horse-driven crane, and just to give you a rough idea, so when this horse starts to run and spins the wheel, and this gear here will lift up that weight. But like, it's pretty much like this crane also in a transceiver, even the tiniest gear wheel in there, if this is going to be break, this might crash the gear, but it can be even worse. Some other components might be also influenced by that crash, like here that weight, it will run down and destroy something else. This can also happen at transceiver, so if one component fails inside there, it might can crash other components as well and destroy the entire transceiver at the end of the day. So far for the production, the overall goal in production is for sure having a do it in a certain amount of time, cut down the timing there for sure, but cover the maximum of test cases and also the proper test cases there. As I mentioned at the beginning in the presentation, I do have a second component in there, or actually it's the third one, the DSP. And it holds also the function of the forward error correction. What does the forward error correction do? And actually, we know it already a little bit when we look in 10 gigabit. We have something like error detection already. When you look at the Ethernet frame, you have at the end, you have a cycling redundancy checksum at the end, which is calculated over the Ethernet frame. And with that checksum, you can actually do detection. now at 100 gigabit at certain applications, it's up 100 gigabit and definitely mandatory for 400 gigabit. Beside detection, we also need correction, and we need forward error correction to correct errors which will happen on the line. How is that basically done? Pretty simple. In 100 gigabit, you have a FEC encoder on your switch. It adds some overhead that we'll show in the next slide a little bit more. Brings the signal with the payload on the line, and on the other side, we have the FEC decoder, which takes off the overhead and gives the payload actually to the ASIC, and then you can do all the Ethernet stuff there. Now, how it actually does it work? When you look at that payload, and I took that artificial example here of that tiny lorry, so that lorry actually is our FEC encoder, and inside that lorry we have bricks, and these bricks are in a certain order, so we have blue, red, yellow, green, and blue again. And when in the second step our lorry hits the road and all the bricks get somehow disordered, and even one brick is lost actually down there, on this third step we have the excavator, which is our FEC decoder, and he has the capability to bring all the bricks in order again, and even can make it happen that the blue brick is back in the payload of the lorry. What you can imagine, this process takes a little bit time. Like that excavator, it takes a little bit of time to bring all the bricks back in order in that lorry. The same applies for a FEC. So a FEC typically, when you do detection and correction, it takes you roughly, depending on the implementation of that FEC, of 100 nanoseconds of delay. How powerful is such a FEC in these days? The typically, which is used in Ethernet, can correct roughly, when we take a frame, for example, with 1,500 bytes, which end up in 12,000 bits, we can correct up to 330 bits actually there when they are not clustered, when the errors occur in that frame and they are not clustered. But when they are clustered at a certain spot, then the performance really gets worse, and we get down to roughly 33 bits in the worst circumstance to correct these errors there. How will it look like in 400 gigabit? It will be more complicated actually. So we still have the FEC encoder on the switch side, called it here FEC2, and then it's encoded. But then on the transceiver side, we also have a FEC. This FEC, first of all, does a decoding of, so we took care about the connection between the ASIC and the transceiver itself on the traces on our PCB of the switch. And then it's again encoded in the transceiver, brought onto the line on the fiber, and then on the other side in the transceiver, the FEC decodes it, the line signal, encodes it for the host signal actually, and then on the switch side, we do decoding again. This, first of all, at the end of the day, you will have not only two FECs involved, you have at the worst circumstances four FECs involved. This will add an more delay actually to your link, and it will consume power. The FEC inside that transceiver will take roughly 2 watts just to do the FEC performance to do it. And there are actually two scenarios when you're in a practical attempt, which we also learned in 100 gigabit, where you might look to the FEC. By default, the FEC should be enabled automatically based on the type of transceiver which is plugged in. And in 400 gigabit, it also needs to make sure which FEC is going to be enabled, the switch FEC or the transceiver FEC. And if for example, if you don't have, or if the switch doesn't enable the FEC at all, and you see bit errors on your link itself, you might going to double check the setting of the FEC. Maybe it happened, and we have seen that scenarios, that the FEC was not enabled. This is a good chance when you enable the FEC manually on both sides, and then you get a bit error link free. And the second scenario could also be you can't establish your link at all. You might gonna check the amount of FECs which are gonna be involved, because when you have an unequal amount of FECs involved, like three, it won't work at all. Like here in this example, the excavator, he can't handle a bobby car, but he can handle a lorry, but still the bobby car is way too big for it. And so you need really to check both sides which fake is enabled and not, if the link can't establish at all. Yeah, brings me almost to the end of the presentation. What happens new in the market, or what is gonna be the latest developments there? And I'm pretty proud to actually to announce now that we got the first 400 gigabit link tested, and it's already in production since last week. Up to 2 kilometers, it's working. That's pretty cool. And yeah, what will happen on 400 gigabit? You might remember the presentation last year on DNUG, where I also introduced the different standards for 400 gigabit, and I also mentioned a little bit about LR4. LR4 is still not defined completely when it comes to the wavelengths which are going to be selected. So there are different forces or people who want to push LR4, so typically 10 kilometer application on single mode fiber, to a CWDM4 wavelength grid, which is a spacing of 20 nanometers, which is actually quite new when you compare it with 100 gigabit, because at 100 gigabit LR4, we are used to LAN WDM, which has a spacing of 5 nanometer. And it's still, I just double checked it yesterday, it's still not defined which selection will be done, if it's either LAN WDM or CWDM4 wavelength grid for the standard, for the LR4 standard, and hopefully there will be soon a solution out there. Or actually, physically, it's doable, both solutions. It's, at the end of the day, it's a matter how much it's going to be cost, because the LAN WDM is way more expensive to produce than the CWDM4 wavelength grid. What happened on 100 gig? I expected not much happening in the last month on 100 gigabit, and somehow the landmark was 25, 30 kilometers with a single transceiver without amplification getting there. But suddenly, ER4, 40 kilometers in ZR4, 80 kilometers straight out of a transceiver without amplification occurred, and it's available and also producible. That's pretty cool. So we are actually a little bit back where we are with 10 gigabit, can do a dark fiber straight up to 80 kilometers without any amplification, which is pretty nice. And one side story, what I see on the market is a little bit about 50 gig Ethernet, ER, or it can also be an LR solution up to 40 kilometers, and LR up to 10 kilometers. This is more like a looking glass from my side. There might be a chance that the 50 gig Ethernet, which is mainly developed or was developed for the 5G mobile operators, connecting their poles to the 5G network, that this can have an influence also on the data center side, because when you look or on the ISP side, because when you look inside a switch, the ASIC which is built in there has the capability to run, let's take a 400 gigabit ASIC, he can do 400 gigabit, but also 200, 100, 50, 40, 25, 10 gigabit. Technically, the ASIC is able to handle 50 gig Ethernet. It's more a question, is the operating system of the switch can handle it? And why is it an interesting technology? Because in the 5G world, it's a massive deployment of those components, and that the prices of 50 gig Ethernet will, on the transceiver side, it will drop tremendously, or starting actually in a really low level, because there are huge amount of components involved to get a deployment done. And this might be an interesting solution also on an ISP side, if when there is not 100 gigabit needed, and you need really to look on the costs. But as I said, it depends on the switch operating system or the router operating system, if it will support 50 gig Ethernet. And then on the single lambda side, we do see 25 gig DWDM LR4 available and usable, and the same for 40 gig DWDM, one wavelength up to 11 dB power budget. Yeah. Microphone drops off. I hold it, but I'm over, well, finished. In time, there's not much to add from my side. It leaves us a lot of freedom to, when it comes to when we look at the 400 gigabit now, beside the microcontroller, which we already know to how to tweak with the Flexbox, there will be a new component, DSP, which also needs firmware upgrades, configuration changes. That's going to be a new
new world for us as well, and we are looking forward to do it. So let's see what's going to be happening up to next year. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Any questions?
I fixed the microphone again. There is a question.
Hi, Jean-Pierre from Hilotech. I have a question about the cooling. Do you see it as realistic to have those switches with 100 gig in a cabinet at the end of the hall to a link, for example, buildings without cooling, or will those switches always need to be in a climatized room in the future? Where do you see the limit for the temperature before it heats too much?
That's actually more switch window question, actually, how they make the design of the switch, because when you look at the transceiver itself, a 100 gig transceiver has roughly 5 watts of heat dissipation. A 400 gig will be 15, 20 watts, which is actually, compared to the overall system, not much. But I haven't seen a solution yet where you can't do it without active cooling so far. Does this answer the question?
The 100 gig ER4, are they in the DWDM grid? And when do you think they are available for testing?
The ER4s are available. They are available, even the ZR4. And they are in the 1310 nanometer window, the typical 1310 nanometer, starting from 1270 up to 1330 nanometer.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. For the 400G, the forward error correction be done in the switch, in the transceiver, in both, in neither. That sounds pretty confusing and error prone. Isn't there any standardization on the way?
Yes, there is. I don't know. To be honest, I don't know which FEC is involved at what at which stage. What I know so far at 100 gig, there's the definition to say SR4 needs the FEC by default on the switching side. Also, CWDM4 needs it, but LR4 doesn't need it. On the 400 gig, LR4 is not standardized yet, so I can't tell you where they will go. And I don't know the numbers or the actually setting for SR or DR4, FR4. Let's see where it will go. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
All right.